Good afternoon, everybody. It's Robin Gullison from the Harbor Group. Thank you very much for joining us on our January 7, 2017 conference call. We have a very special guest today. We have Mr. Phil Langham, the head of emerging market equities and a senior portfolio manager at RBC Global Asset Management, calling in from London today. That's why the call is at noon today instead of 4 p.m. Phil is the head of emerging market equities at RBC Global Asset Management. He leads a team of 9 investment professionals dedicated to emerging market equities. He's been in the industry since 1992, specializing in emerging markets, and he joined RBC in 2009. So I've got a list of questions here I'd like to ask Phil about emerging markets equities and how they approach that asset class. And with that, we'll just get right to it. Phil, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. If you could speak up slightly, that would be great.
Yeah.
It might just be my phone here. So thank you very much for joining us today. And as I mentioned, there are some questions I'd like to ask you. And for everybody else on the call, we do have a copy of a presentation Phil has provided with us. That's up on our website. I believe the link is in the conference call invitation, so he may refer to some of those charts during the call here, and you can grab that presentation from our website. And Phil, I guess I'll start off from the kind of a broad strokes question. You know, for Canadian investors, what's the benefit of having emerging markets exposure in their portfolio?
Yeah, sure. Really, the key reason to be exposed to emerging markets is that emerging markets over time have been a growth asset. They've tended to grow much faster than other regions in the world. I think one good way of illustrating that is if we look at chart number 2, what we can see is that if we look at the grey shaded bar here, is that some 20 years ago, emerging markets represented something like 30% of global GDP. That's now gone up to 55% of global GDP. And we can see that from the blue bar, that even over the last few years when emerging market growth has been slowing, emerging markets have still broadly been contributing something like 65-70% of global GDP growth. So really growth is the key reason. In terms of where we go from here in terms of growth, well, we feel that emerging markets still have got a number of different reasons for continuing to grow faster than developed market. The sorts of factors that have historically caused emerging markets to consistently grow faster are still very much intact. For me, the most important factors here are favorable demographics, the fact that virtually all the world's working age population growth from here is coming from emerging markets. The much lower debt that you see in emerging markets, debt has continued to expand in developed markets, particularly at the government level over recent years, but it's still very low in emerging markets. Urbanization, the ability to catch up in terms of productivity, underpenetrated credit, and a growing middle class. I think if you look at the third slide that I had, really this illustrates the catch-up potential that still exists in emerging markets. So we can see that EM GDP per capita, despite the rapid growth that we've seen over the last few years in the blue bars, is still just a fraction of GDP per capita in the developed world.
Great. Thanks a lot, Phil. And can you give us a bit of a background on your team? I kind of gave a broad overview. But can you tell us about the kind of the depth of the team you have working with you and, you know, what kind of sort of background they have, how many people, that sort of thing, just to give everybody on the call kind of a sense of the, you know, what RBC brings to bear in this asset class?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got a chart of the team on slide 4. I joined RBC at the end of 2009 to set up the emerging markets team. Before I joined RBC, I was head of emerging markets at SocGen Asset Management, so doing a very similar role, and before that, head of Asia and emerging markets at Credit Suisse. But really what attracted me to RBC was that I felt there was a very strong fit in terms of culture, process, philosophy. From my point of view, I was very excited at the prospect of being able to grow my own team from scratch. But really the key thing for me was the commitment that was shown by the senior management at RBC towards really wanting to grow in emerging markets and to hire a very strong team. So in terms of investment people, the team has grown to eight. We also have, as you can see, two IPMs, Nicole and Stephen in Toronto, who many of you may know. I very much feel that seven to eight people is the ideal team size. It really ensures that everyone's fully engaged, that everyone feels part of the process, that everyone feels real ownership of the stocks. And what I've looked for in terms of building up the team has been to try and find people who are naturally intellectually curious, people who want to better themselves, people who are humble, but above all, people who are team-orientated. As a team, we have a real culture of collaboration. We're a very diverse team. I think that really adds to the way we work. And for us, constant discussion, constant debate is really important in terms of how we work as a team. And you can see from this slide that we've got a lot of experience within the team. I've been doing emerging markets for about 24 and a half years now. So when I first started doing emerging markets, it was a really tiny asset class, just a handful of investors, a handful of companies. We've got two or three in the team who've got sort of 15 years plus experience, and the others have all got 6-7 years plus experience.
Great. Thanks a lot, Bill. You know, one of the things we've always kind of looked at when we look at emerging markets is that historically, the TSX has had a pretty high correlation with the emerging markets index, you know, due to the big commodity concentration in both. You know, how does your approach differ, and has the emerging markets, the composition differed, or is it still more of a commodity play?
Well, it has changed a lot over the last few years. And I think that perhaps there's a couple of angles to your question. I think the first one that we often get asked and that I think is quite important to address is should people or would people be sort of better off being in an ETF? And the second aspect, the commodity aspect, I'll also address. The first aspect, as to, you know, obviously we're seeing a lot of talk in a number of different markets about passive versus active. But I'd say that the one asset class where it really makes sense to be active is in emerging markets, because the benchmark is so inefficient. If you look at the benchmark, there are a very high number of poorly run companies. Something like 30% of the emerging market benchmark is in state-owned enterprises, which really are not run for large shareholders, so the Russian energy companies, the Chinese banks. And obviously, if you go passive, you'll be investing in these. But also, there's a lot of attractive opportunities outside of the benchmark, small-cap stocks, which are predominantly domestically orientated, which aren't geared to commodities, frontier stocks, developed market stocks that are predominantly emerging markets. And even some of the more attractive themes within the benchmark actually have an extremely low weighting. So themes such as healthcare or infrastructure. Now, as far as commodities themselves are concerned, we've seen a dramatic reduction in the weighting of commodities within the emerging market benchmark. If we turn to slide six that I've had, I think this really illustrates the fact that over the last few years, if you look at emerging markets, the weighting of energy and materials has gone from almost 40% down at the beginning of this year to around 14%, 14-15%, only 2 or 3% higher than developed markets overall. Now, at the same time, I think I don't have the exact weighting of commodities within the TSX, But I know that it hasn't fallen anything like as much and still represents a very high part of the TSX. I think the days when people used to look at emerging markets as really being a commodity play have largely gone. Emerging markets have very much moved on to being much more of a domestic play. They're much more driven by factors such as domestic consumption, financials, and really materials and energy are a much less significant part of what is driving emerging markets now.
Great, thank you. And as far as, you know, emerging markets have historically had higher growth rates than developed economies, is that a trend that's set to continue as far as any reasonable forecast would go?
Yes, I would say so. I think what we've seen over the last few years is that emerging market growth has slowed compared to developed markets, but emerging markets are still growing much faster than developed markets. And actually, our feeling is that from here, the gap is likely to accelerate. So if we look at chart 7, what we can see is that in 2011, emerging markets were growing roughly 6.5% a year, developed markets 1.5%, so there's a gap of almost 5%. We've seen that gap narrow in 2015, really down to about 2% or just under 2%. If we look at IMF forecasts, we can see on this chart that from here, that gap is expected to accelerate. And typically what we've seen over time is that gap has tended to vary between about 2% and 5%. So obviously 2015, we were at the low point of that. It does tend to be cyclical, and certainly over coming years, we would expect the gap to start to accelerate again.
Okay, great. And kind of digging down a little more into what the stock markets look like, you know, as far as valuations go, are we seeing emerging market stocks? Is that stronger growth reflected in valuations? Do they trade at a higher price earnings multiple or price to book multiple than developed market stocks? And how does the current valuation compare to the history for emerging markets?
Yeah, but I mean, that's a good question. So I think, first of all, when thinking about valuation, it's also good to think about earnings growth. So it's one thing having faster GDP growth, but does that translate into earnings growth? Obviously, that's very important for valuation. Well, yes, it has historically. If we look at chart 8, we can see that going back really over the last 11 years, which includes the periods of relatively slower growth in emerging markets, we can see that despite that, emerging market earnings growth has been considerably faster than developed market earnings growth, so 12% against 5.5%. And going back over longer periods, we can see that that's the sort of gap that has historically occurred. Now, as a result of emerging markets on the performance over the last 5 or 6 years, so emerging markets, you know, last year slightly outperformed developed markets, but for the 5 previous years, there was almost 50% of underperformance, and that's actually extremely unusual. As a result of that very significant underperformance, I've got two charts on slide 9 that look at price to book. We can see that the price to book of emerging markets, despite last year's rally, is still sort of towards the low end of where it tends to trade. So we're at a price to book of just over 1.5. Historically, the average has been nearer 2. But in terms of the discount to developed markets, you can see from the right-hand chart on slide 9 that emerging markets are trading at something like a 30% price-to-book discount. They have tended historically to trade at a slight discount, but 30% is certainly quite extended. And the PE discount, although I don't have a chart on it, is also similarly around 30%.
Okay, great. So pretty attractive valuations. And what, I guess, what gives you confidence that this trend is about to change for the better?
I'd say, you know, but what I think is really key to emerging market performance is a recovery in both earnings and GDP growth. The two tend to go hand in hand. And I touched on the fact that you know, over the last few years, we've seen a slowdown in the relative growth of emerging markets, but 2015 seems to be the bottom, and it seems to be a sort of a cyclical series, and that, you know, over coming years, we can expect the growth differential between emerging markets and developed markets to start to pick up. Now, I think this is an extremely important driver for overall relative performance in emerging markets. And a very good way of illustrating this is the chart that you can see on slide 10. So what you can see here is this chart is going back almost 50 years, that we've really had three or four cycles in emerging markets where emerging markets have had long periods of outperformance and long periods of underperformance relative to developed markets, and that the key driver for those long periods of outperformance and long periods of underperformance has been the relative growth differential. What we can see from this chart is that over the last 5 or 6 years, really until last year, that growth differential was narrowing, but has now shown signs of stabilizing, and last year we started to see much better relative performance from emerging markets. Now, interestingly, what we've seen historically is that in the periods when growth has slowed in emerging markets, so perhaps the best illustration of this would be the Asia crisis in the late 90s, but that has tended to encourage reforms, and that those reforms over the medium term have tended to lead to an improvement in medium-term growth. We saw a bunch of reforms at the end of the 90s, and that led to the very strong decade of growth that we saw starting in the year 2000 and the very strong performance that we saw from emerging markets. And we feel that over the last 2 or 3 years, similarly, we've seen a number of pro-investment friendly governments be elected throughout emerging markets. We're starting to see a series of reforms in a number of different countries. I think we've got a chart illustrating those reforms really being very widespread on slide 11. The exact reforms vary by country and will depend on really what's necessary. But what is significant is that so many different emerging market countries are actually producing reforms, have been for 1 or 2 years, and that these reforms eventually are going to lead to an improvement in economic growth in emerging markets. We're already starting to see signs of that, and also an improvement in the earnings outlook for emerging markets.
So even though we're seeing a lot of the developed world go more populist, more protectionist, we're starting, you know, which is traditionally an emerging markets trait, they're starting to turn the other way, would you say? Like, I think of things like Argentina, for example. And
absolutely. So they are starting to go the other way. And what's interesting, actually, if you look at trade data, is that trade overall has been relatively sluggish for the last 2 or 3 years. And I think that's a sign of some of the sort of creeping protectionism that we've been seeing in the developed world. But actually, intra-emerging market trade has really been accelerating, has been growing quite well. I think a good example would be a country like Korea. 5 or 6 years ago, literally 100% of its exports went to developed markets. Now, something like 35% of its exports go to other emerging markets. So intra-emerging market trade is accelerating, while exports to developed markets have slowed.
So I guess that's kind of a virtuous cycle, that you're selling more to companies that are countries that are growing faster.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's really why the whole, for me, you know, the whole story in emerging markets is much more about domestic stocks, so stocks that are geared to consumption, to healthcare, to financials, and that's really the way that our portfolio is positioned. It's much more positioned in in those areas rather than excuse me, rather than commodities or exporters, which we feel are likely to come under pressure.
Okay, great. And I guess one of the things we've seen that's kind of given emerging markets a hard time is when you see really significant U.S. dollar strength, and you've had a pretty big move post-U.S. election in the U.S. dollar. Is that kind of reflected in valuations at this point?
Yeah. What I'd say on the dollar is we've been in a strong U.S. dollar environment for the last 6 years. And generally what we've seen in more recent years is that dollar cycles have tended to last something like a maximum of 7 years. So I think we're getting towards the end of the dollar bull run. But certainly as you touched on, the Trump re-election has given the dollar another boost. What's interesting is that last year, despite the fact that we saw dollar strength, actually emerging market currencies in aggregate slightly outperformed the dollar. And our feeling is that that's a trend that we're likely to see, that even in a strong dollar environment, that actually emerging market currencies can still do well. And really three reasons for that. So first of all, the fact that most of the dollar strength at the moment is really against other developed market currencies, so the euro, the yen, the pound, where fundamentals are weak, the monetary policy is still ultra loose. There's a real lack of growth in those markets. Secondly, emerging markets currency valuations have really collapsed over the last 5 or 6 years following the weakness that we've seen. And on almost every valuation measure, the currencies look extremely cheap. And I think we've got a chart on that. So if we look at chart 14 on the left-hand side, we can see the performance of emerging market currencies. We can see how weak it's been over the last 5 or 6 years, but it actually started to stabilize last year. On the right-hand chart, you can see the valuation is really down to so the valuation difference is reflected in on the y-axis. So you can see that the discount in terms of PPP is something like 60-65%, which is as low as it's been in the last 15 years. And we've got a couple of other measures of valuation on the next slide, which really show a very similar picture. And then the third factor is that we're seeing other fundamentals in EM improve. The current account deficits that we had 4 or 5 years ago have turned to surpluses, strong balance sheets, strong reserves, and much higher real rates in emerging markets. So I think all these factors for us lead us to believe that emerging market currencies, which are very important, you do tend to see that the currency and the market moves in the same direction in emerging markets, that even in a strong dollar environment, we can continue to see emerging market currencies do well.
And I guess sticking with currency, what's the philosophy on the funds you manage for hedging the currencies?
We don't hedge currencies, first of all, because for a lot of currencies you can't, or it's extremely expensive. Also, our feeling is that long-term emerging market currencies are cheap and will appreciate. But I think even more importantly is the fact that what you see in emerging markets is that the currency and the market tend to move in the same direction. So we would say that for anyone who's particularly nervous on emerging market currencies, that it would make more sense to have a smaller allocation to emerging markets with the currency unhedged than a larger allocation with the currency hedged.
Okay, great, thank you. And how big of an effect does China have? You know, China presumably has quite a large weight in the emerging markets index. Does that affect your positioning a lot, and with the risks around China? Every 6 months somebody seems to be worried about a big Chinese currency devaluation or a debt bubble, et cetera. What do you think about China and the risks there?
Yeah, no, that's a good and very important question. I think, first of all, perhaps to tackle what I would see and I think most people would see as being the biggest risk in China, and that is the risk of a renminbi devaluation. Now, when I mentioned that currencies in emerging markets look cheap, perhaps the one exception is the Chinese renminbi, which has been relatively strong over recent years, and doesn't look particularly cheap. Certainly, one risk that was apparent, probably more sort of 6 to 9 months ago, was the risk of a devaluation. That was really driven by the very large capital outflows that we saw. And a good way of showing capital outflows that have been occurring in China is on slide 12, which looks at foreign exchange reserves. Now, what's clear is that most of the outflows that we've seen have been driven really by two factors. First of all, by Chinese corporates repatriating dollar debt, and secondly, by foreigners unwinding carry trade positions in the renminbi. If we look at both of those, really, for the most part, both of those have now pretty much fully unwound. So there are very few renminbi carry trade positions and very, very little US dollar debt held by corporates. So from here, most of the outflows, if we were to see further outflows, will be from individuals. Now, there's a lot of capital restrictions on individuals, making it difficult for them to move money out. But we also think that Chinese authorities are going to have to keep rates relatively high to ensure that we don't see more outflows. In terms of government policy, we think it's highly unlikely that the government would want to see a significant devaluation, because it's very much government policy to see a rebalancing of growth away from investment towards consumption. So a large devaluation would not be consistent with that. And for the most part, we think that the government certainly has control of the capital account. So we don't think that a significant devaluation is likely, although we do think that the sort of thing that we're seeing at the moment, which is against the US dollar, a creeping devaluation against other currencies, that really the renminbi is holding up and pretty flat against a trade weighted basket. But against the US dollar, which has obviously been quite strong, we're seeing something like 4 or 5% depreciation per annum, and we think that that's relatively likely to carry on. Otherwise, in China, I think that essentially the policy that the government has of gradually rebalancing the economy is broadly working. The rebalancing is happening sort of fairly slowly, I would say, but it is happening. And I'm not sure if we Yeah, we do have one chart on that slide 13, which looks at the various sources of growth. And you can see in the grey bars that consumption has gradually been accelerating, while gross capital formation in the blue bars has gradually been coming down. It is a relatively slow rebalancing, but it is occurring. I would probably prefer to see it occurring more quickly. We are also seeing reforms coming from China, so anti-corruption, more privatization, financial sector liberalization. I think the big issue for China is that there's still an obsession on the overall level of growth, an obsession from Chinese policymakers, but also from commentators. My own view is that it would be better to see China accept that it needs to grow slower and to accept a lower pace of GDP growth. But even last year, China still grew 6.5% and is expected to grow at similar levels for the next 3 or 4 years. And that means that the sort of reforms that China needs will occur, but will occur much more slowly than I think would be ideal. The other issue with China, and for me probably the biggest issue, is really the amount of debt that's in China. And in particular, it's the pace of growth of the debt that we've seen over the last few years. I think, you know, that we'll continue to see China muddle through. What I think is also important is that, you know, what we see from a macroeconomic point of view and what we see on the ground are often two very different things. There's a whole host of different quality of Chinese companies. There are a lot of companies, of course, with poor corporate governance, companies that are driven by the state. But we're also starting to meet a lot of interesting private companies that are really well run, that are able to take advantage of some of the reforms that we're seeing. A lot of undiscovered Chinese companies. So overall, our feeling is still to be cautious on China, to be cautious on the macroeconomics, to be extremely careful on factors such as corporate governance. We do see some opportunities, and we're extremely careful when we invest in China. But generally, for the most part, the Chinese companies that we have invested in have actually been very, very good performers. So we're overweight, we're very underweight in China, but we do find some interesting stocks to invest in.
Okay, great. And I guess so, just to kind of summarize everything, it sounds like, you know, in emerging markets, equity markets, you have economies that are growing faster than developed markets, you have valuations that are lower, and you have a currency that's trading at a fairly low level that tends to be positively correlated with the equity market. So it seems like a pretty favorable setup for investors.
Yeah, I think those are the key points. But having sort of, I think we're coming to the end of a cyclically difficult position, difficult time for emerging markets. And from here, earnings and GDP growth look set to accelerate. Valuations are attractive, and the currencies look attractive too. So absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much, Phil. We really appreciate you dialing in today. I know it's late in the day over there, so thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it. And to everyone else on the call, thank you for dialing in, and we will join you next month. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.